That sounds good.
I did it. I got it. Okay, turning it over.
Welcome, and I think we have a very nice evening for the graduates, and it's fun always to be able to start off with a distinguished graduation speaker. I was laughing and telling Ed, for some reason, the layout of the room tonight is a little bit Ebola virus-like. You're back there, and the speaker's up here, but the speaker is very friendly, and you don't have to fear her. She is an old friend of mine, and normally we reach out for our graduation speakers to other places, but Autumn and I were talking earlier, way earlier this year, and I said, you know, Anita Allen is now on the President's Commission. She's been a significant contributor to areas ranging from privacy to mental health. She had my son in her class. She's at the law school here, and he said she was okay. We should get Anita. We should ask her, and we did, and she was very gracious in accepting our invitation. So it really is fun to have a friend and a supporter, and for some of you, a teacher, as our speaker. She is the Henry R. Silverman Professor of Law and a professor of philosophy here at the University of Pennsylvania. She's also been serving for a while as the Deputy Dean for Academic Affairs at the law school, which I think is coming to a end that she would view with some gratitude soon. She's a fellow, a senior fellow actually, in the Center for Bioethics. She has both a law degree and a PhD in philosophy. When I first met Anita, she was working at the National Endowment for the Humanities. At the time, she was about 8 years old. I was significantly older, but I listened to her talk and attended some meetings with her, and I was just blown away. I thought, this woman is smart and poised and really understands how to integrate both ethics, law, and philosophy. She has been a prolific author. She is, we're lucky to have her because she's always being invited all around the world to lecture. And it's been fun for me in particular to hear about her experience on the President's Council right now that Obama appointed, that Amy Gutman directs. People often ask me, does the Bioethics Center have a presence on the council? And I say, oh yeah, we have a big presence, it's Anita. So she's been involved in public policy, theoretical work, legal work. Really, there's no part of bioethics that she hasn't touched. And so we asked her to take on the easily addressed topic of the future of bioethics, which I think she will be able to wrap up in about 40 minutes, but that shouldn't scare the graduates. There's probably a longer future than we've given her time to talk about. Anita.
Thank you, Art, and everyone. I would tell you, Art, how well your son did in my class, but that would violate several federal laws, I believe, so I can't tell you. Well, I did write a talk called The Future of Bioethics, and then about 3 days later I said, this is the most boring talk I've ever written. I can't give this talk. So I wrote a different talk, which is called The Future of Bioethics, : Protecting Health Privacy in the Age of Social Networking. So, we do live, as you know, in an era of personal revelation. We're preoccupied with seeking, with gathering, and with disclosing information about ourselves and other people. In this age of revelation, we are fond of ferreting out what's been buried away. We're fond of broadcasting what we know, what we think, what we do, what we feel. We're motivated by business and by pleasure, and because we care about friendship and kinship and health and politics and culture and justice. We live at a historical moment characterized by the wide availability of multiple modes of communication, like cell phones and PDAs and notepads and laptops and desktops. And these are all readily and frequently accessed, capable of disclosing breadths and depths of personal identifiable and sensitive information to many people rapidly. That's our context. So, in this era of personal revelation, what happens to personal privacy? And what in particular happens to medical privacy, to health care privacy? Well, I'm afraid that in the age of revelation, health information, along with information about our marital infidelity and our diplomatic missives, I love WikiLeaks, everything comes to light. Everything comes to light. So in my remarks today, I want to suggest quoting a line from one of my favorite Broadway musicals, Wicked. How many have seen it? Wicked? Remember the professor? He's a goat, right? So quoting from him, when it comes to medical privacy in the era of Facebook and WikiLeaks, something bad is happening. Something bad is happening in Oz. It's not clear to me that either our laws or our professional ethics are any match for the seductive lure of social networking. Thus, not only does the medical consumer, the patient, have to worry about things like inadvertent data security breaches and medical identity theft, but also about people using Facebook against them. So I'm going to give you a couple of concrete examples straight off the pages of the law books, real people, real lawsuits, real bioethics. So the first example is one which I'm going to nickname the case of the fresh placenta. Yes, I did say fresh placenta. And this case might not strike you as all that bad an example of what's happening to privacy, and it may not even strike you as being about privacy at all. But the second example I'm going to give you, the case of rotten candy, will very much, I believe, strike you as a strong signal that we are in trouble when it comes to privacy, medical privacy, and the age of social networking. So first, the first case, case of fresh placenta. So a woman named Doyle Burns was a nursing student. Actually, she is a nursing student. She was and is a nursing student at Johnson County Community College in the Midwest. And in 2010, she was expelled from nursing school for what the administrators of her school considered to be inappropriate conduct on Facebook. She apologized for her conduct, but she felt that expulsion from professional school was not called for, way too serious a sanction for her offense. So she actually sued in federal court to get herself back into school. And the judge, the Kansas Federal District Court judge who heard her case, sided with her. So in January 19th of this year, 2011, Judge Eric Melgren issued a preliminary injunction ordering not only that Ms. Burns be reinstated, but that she be allowed to take all the missed exams and missed assignments and be fully restored to good standing. So what did Burns do in the first place to get herself expelled? Well, on November 10th, 2010, she was asked to participate with her other classmates in a clinical course on obstetrics and gynecology at the Olathe Medical Center in Olathe, Kansas. And as part of the course, she was required to physically examine fresh placenta from recently delivered pregnancies. Well, Burns and three of her fellow nursing students, Christy North, Jamie Brake, and Danielle Thompson, thought it would be really cool to photograph themselves examining the placenta and post it on Facebook. Well, they got permission from their professor, their supervisor, Amber Delphia, to photograph themselves examining a placenta specimen derived from a recent birth. And the permission, though, was granted on the condition that they removed any identifying marks from the photograph, so one couldn't tell from the photograph whose placenta it was. It wasn't until after class that the instructor decided to ask the students, well, what do you intend to do with the photographs? And one of the women was quite, you know, honest and frank. Well, we're going to post it on Facebook. And the instructor said, oh, you girls. Well, when it came to the attention of the college that the photographs of the nursing students with placenta actually had been posted on Facebook, the girls were expelled. So the judge enjoined Burns' expulsion for several reasons. First, she noted that the conduct was inappropriate, offensive to the school, but it didn't really violate a clearly stated school rule. There was no school rule saying you may not post pictures of yourself with specimens on the internet. There was no such rule. So the judge felt that it was sort of unfair to kick her out of school when she didn't break a discreet specific rule. Second thing is that he said, well, since photographs are meant to be shared face-to-face, on the internet, however, when the professor authorized taking the photograph, she was implicitly authorizing any sharing of the photograph, even on the internet, even on Facebook, anywhere. And finally, the judge argued that by only saying, oh, you girls, as was alleged, she, the professor, missed an opportunity to object on school policy grounds, on legal grounds, on professional ethical grounds, to the posting of images of placenta. And she gave the students the impression that it would be sort of, you know, cheeky but not wrong, right, to post the photographs. The school argued that somebody might be able to figure out whose placenta it was. They might, for example, look at the date and the time of the posting on Facebook and infer, given the number of births that occurred during that time period, to some level of certainty whose placenta it was, and that would be an invasion of privacy. But the judge thought that was rather far-fetched. And you can imagine, I sort of agree, I mean, in a large, busy hospital especially, there's so many births and people wouldn't, you know, ever be able to really put two and two together and come up with four. So I kind of agree with the judge. But I do think that there's some kind of uneasy something going on in this case. There's some kind of ethical failing involved. And it's not so much a breach of patient confidentiality or an invasion of patient privacy, although you could kind of stretch it and see it that way. It's rather a lack of professional dignity and respect for patients. I mean, how would you feel if you, a recently delivered mother, learned that the nurses at your hospital were parading around Facebook holding placentas, right? I mean, and how would you feel? How would you feel, especially if your baby had been stillborn, or if your baby had been born with a disability? You might be still grieving, and it might really upset you to know this is how the nursing students treat your placenta. And then there's always the slippery slope concern. Today it's placenta, tomorrow it's a severed hand, right? And now we, you know, so the issues get more sensitive, more delicate, more identification might be possible. And I think that line of thinking explains why some of us are uneasy about the idea of having nursing students, you know, to display their work specimens on Facebook. Let me give you another case where everybody would agree there's a serious privacy problem. And I want to point out to you that there's not, unfortunately, right now, enough ethics in place, enough law in place to prevent this kind of thing from happening. This is a case of rotten candy. So Candace Yath, that's her name, Candace Yath, Y-A-T-H, was a patient at the Fairview Clinic in Minnesota. And she revealed to her physician that she was having an extramarital affair. She was concerned about having a sexually transmitted disease, and she wanted to be tested and treated if necessary. And so she was. It turned out she did have an STD for which she was treated. So the day she was at the clinic, a woman who happened to be a relative of Candace's husband, not the boyfriend but the husband, saw her in the clinic and became curious. Why is she here? So this relative, whose name was Navy Tech, interesting name, Navy Tech, T-E-K, she happened to be a medical assistant at the hospital with access to electronic records, health records. So she just goes online and she sees that, oh my God, Candace has an STD, Candace is having an extramarital affair. So she's able to sit on her juicy gossip for 2 days, but then she just has to tell somebody. So she emails Candace's sister-in-law, whose name is Net Fat. who's also a medical worker, by the way, and says, I got to tell you something. I can't put it in email, but call me, right? So they get on the telephone, and she tells the shocking news. So now two people know who aren't supposed to know. Short time later, Fat, who also can't keep her mouth shut, decides she has to tell her brother what she's learned about his wife. So she does, and of course the husband files for divorce. About that time, a MySpace page appears with a picture of Candace, a real picture of Candace, with her real name, but also labeled Rotten Candy. And the page stated that Candace had a sexually transmitted disease, she cheated on her husband, and she was addicted to plastic surgery. I don't know where that came from, but that was also one of the things that was there. Who put the page up? It wasn't real clear at first. When Candace and her grandmother discovered the page, they were arguably understandably upset. They called the clinic and said, you gotta do something about this. One of your healthcare workers has probably put this page up. It turned out that it was the sister of Navy Tech, the woman who actually initially went online to look at the record. Her sister, whose name was Malika Mao, she's the one who, from her workplace, put up the MySpace page, the Dirty Candy MySpace page. So, unsurprisingly, Candace brought a lawsuit against Tech, Fat, and Mao, and Fairview Clinics. She alleged that all the defendants had violated her privacy rights. She alleged that Mao had, and everybody else had breached her confidentiality rights in violation of common law, state statutes, and that everybody had inflicted emotional distress upon her, either intentionally or negligently. And there were a number of rather complicated legal issues that I won't get into, but one of the interesting issues the judge had to struggle with was whether or not posting the MySpace page, which was only up for 2 or 3 days before it was taken down, but whether that posting constituted publicity. Because if you're going to sue somebody for invasion of privacy under the publication of private facts tort, you have to prove there was a publication. And some courts have held that publication means that the message goes to more than a few people. And so the guilty women who conspired against Candace were arguing, well, only 6 people probably saw this, so not a publication. But the judge, I thought, correctly held that putting up a MySpace page, which is not private, which is open to the public, is kind of like publishing something in the newspaper or putting it on the radio broadcast. You don't know how many people might have seen it. It might be 2 or 3, it might be 6 or 7, but it could be hundreds, it could be thousands. So I like the fact that the judge found that the placing of a MySpace page up was tantamount to newspaper publication or radio broadcast. Nonetheless, there were so many technicalities in this case that poor Candace did not get the kind of relief that she hoped to get. And for, among other things, she was forced to discover that, you know, you don't have an individual private right of action under HIPAA. You know, HIPAA is our health privacy law. You all sign the HIPAA forms constantly. But HIPAA does not give you, the patient, a right to sue anybody. It gives you a right to file a complaint with the Department of Health and Human Services, and they can take action against the healthcare provider. And if you've ever gone to the website of the Department of Health and Human Services and looked at the HIPAA complaints that have been filed and looked at the sanctions, it's all hand slapping. It's all about retraining your employees or, you know, apologizing or, you know, changing. It's never about, you know, money damages. So the incentives here are a little bit weak. And the ability to get remedy is a little bit difficult. And the common law tort and the state law torts, which might be a source of relief, they are good. But again, you have to, you know, jump through various procedural hoops. And it could take not just 1 or 2 years, but 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years to ever get your lawsuit before a judge. So if the parties on the other side don't want to settle, it could be an endless battle to get money damages. So the case of Rotten Candy certainly involves a violation of legal and ethical norms of medical confidentiality. And in so many ways, though, our society is committed to trying to limit access to health information, respect health-related decisions, and honor both individual and community expectations of bodily modesty, intimacy, bodily integrity, and self-ownership. So why do we care about privacy? I mean, the dilemma here, the irony here, it's not really a dilemma, it's an irony here, is that on the one hand, in our general, especially our official capacities, we talk about the importance of privacy. When we philosophers, we lawyers, love to make a long list of all the ways in which confidentiality and medical privacy are beneficial to individuals and to society from a variety of utilitarian and deontological points of view. I'll just hit some of those today. But on the other hand, it seems like our culture is evolving to a point where some of us don't care about our medical privacy at all. You know, we have our babies live online on the internet. We have our mastectomies online. And we really think sharing is more important than privacy. But yet, the specter of having people just cruelly abuse us on social networking sites, I think, is creating a reason to think that even though we may be in a changed ethos, we have reasons to be concerned about the complete lack of concern about the implications of the lack of ethos, the new ethos. So, one reason individuals commonly keep health concerns to themselves is they are concerned about the shame or the fear of being revealed. I have an STD. I don't want you to know that. But some people are just simply reserved. It's not that they're ashamed of having cancer or ashamed of having a gallbladder problem. They're just reserved and just don't care to talk about such things and don't want other people to know about them until unless they reveal them. Health professionals and hospitals and insurers and other entities really are committed to ideals of professional ethics, which put the patient in the driver's seat and give them the ability to limit access to their personal information. They think that's an important thing to do out of respect for autonomy and dignity. Philosophers of medicine, I mean, going way back to Hippocrates and Maimonides, philosophers have always emphasized that there's a connection between protecting confidentiality and getting people to go to the doctor in the first place. If people feel that their medical information is going to be generally public, they may not go and see a healthcare provider out of, again, concern that their sensitive data will be exposed to the general public. So we have reasons to be concerned. And there's issues of fairness here as well. You know, knowledge is power. And if the business community, our health insurance companies, others have the power over us to control our information, then they have a kind of domination potential over us, which I think makes us in a liberal democratic society more than a little bit nervous. Plus, some people believe they actually own their health data, that their genetic test data, that their health information is something they own, they paid for it, and they want to be able to say who gets to see it, who gets to share it. So I could say a lot about that. I'm going to save some of that commentary about the value of privacy for the Q&A if you want to hear more about why philosophers and theorists care about privacy. Just a couple of things, though, might be worth noting. I mean, one of the more recent issues about health privacy that's come to be discussed a lot has to do with the way in which we can conduct research on patients using their medical data, even their genetic data. We can de-identify the file, but re-identification has become a huge issue. And I think that the reason why in the placenta case, the hospital made what was in their context a pretty weak argument about the possibility of re-identification is because in other contexts where researchers are using fairly weak algorithms for scrambling identity, those algorithms can be broken, and we can find out who the people are behind the number or the fake name. So we do have to be concerned about identification and re-identification, and genomic research data has made this issue a really, really important one to explore. Neither the case of the fresh placenta nor the case of rotten candy falls into any of the usual categories of exceptions to privacy or confidentiality requirements. As important as we think privacy and confidentiality are, We think a whole range of reasons exist in the world for not placing privacy above other values. So, for example, we think that if a doctor or a nurse has evidence that a child has been abused, that information should not be kept private, but should be turned over, as the law requires, to a child welfare authority. We believe that while mental health patients should have confidentiality, and their psychotherapists and psychiatrists should not turn over information about their treatment to third parties, generally, we believe in an exception, the Tarasoff rule exception, right? That if the patient who's being seen by a therapist is making credible threats, life-threatening threats against another person, it's appropriate for the healthcare provider to reveal that to the potential victim and or to authorities. So again, just sort of two examples of how we believe that health privacy is not absolute. Other examples, we believe that if some health information which is confidential is needed in a judicial proceeding, there should be some potential for a judge to order, subpoena sensitive health data to make appropriate use in court. And we believe that if national security, for example, depended upon some health information, that we should certainly have the ability to get it, even over the objections of the patient. So, you know, so we think health privacy is important. We believe in exceptions. Unfortunately, getting even with your sister-in-law is not one of the exceptions that I think we recognize, nor is, you know, showing off your new nursing school skills one of the exceptions that we recognize. So, you know, how can we think about the internal sense of it's okay that people who committed those infractions must be living with? The Presidential Commission, Art mentioned that I'm on it, thank you, Art. The Presidential Commission for the Study of Bioethical Issues will soon undertake a study of the bioethics of whole genome sequencing and neuroimaging, including a study of the enormous privacy and personal health information issues raised by sort of unveiling a person's complete genome, and also by unveiling with physical images the brain and how the brain functions. Huge privacy issues are afoot with those two questions. So as a member of the commission and a privacy theorist and a scholar, I am thrilled to have an opportunity to work with Dr. Amy Gutman and the other 12 commissioners on privacy issues. But I am forced into patience because we were told from the beginning of our work that we could select topics to explore, like, you know, synthetic biology or whatever, but if the president asks us to look at a particular topic due to some important sort of late-breaking event, we would have to stop in our tracks and address that event. We have had what Dr. Gutman likes to call Dolly the sheep moments. Remember, Dolly was the clone, first cloned mammal, and when Dolly the sheep was cloned, that was announced, bioethicists stopped in their tracks, put down all their scholarship on euthanasia or whatever else they were doing, and began focusing on cloning and the potential for human cloning. And the Bioethics Council at that time, you know, stopped and looked at the question of human cloning and cloning in general. So that was in 1996. So we've had two scientific sensations already in our short tenure as a commission. We've been in effect for barely a year, and we've had two such moments. So Dolly moment number one occurred, I think, literally 2 weeks after the commission was announced. Last May, the headlines read, Craig Venter creates synthetic life form. Craig Venter and his team have built the genome of a bacterium from scratch and incorporated it into a cell to make what they call the world's first synthetic life form. Scientists creating life from scratch? President Obama asked the commission to look at the ethical issues of synthetic biology and to issue a report within 6 months. And we did. The report is called New Directions, the Ethics of Synthetic Biology and Emerging Technologies. And that was published in last December. It's a fascinating topic. Probably the commission would not have address that topic first, but for the Dolly moment. But it was an interesting and useful topic, and it enabled us to begin to think about, well, what kinds of ethical principles should be applied when we're looking at issues of new technology. The second Dolly moment occurred last October. This time the headlines read, Wellesley medical historian Professor Susan Reverby unearths a horror. Picking through musty files in a Pennsylvania archive, she made a heart-stopping discovery. U.S. government scientists in the 1940s deliberately infected hundreds of Guatemalan prisoners, mental patients, and others with syphilis and gonorrhea in experiments conducted without the subject's permission. Again? So, in response to the discovery that U.S. government agency doctors deliberately infected human beings in a developing country with STDs, had to stop and look at that. President Obama quickly asked the commission to study what had happened, why it happened, and make sure we didn't happen again. He apologized for the U.S. for having performed unethical studies in Latin America in the 1940s. And so we are now in the midst, actually the commission's in the midst of a comprehensive look at our past human subject research abuses and looking at ways we can, again, try to make sure that the United States is not involved in such horrors and abuses in the future. And I'm proud to say that Jonathan Moreno, another Penn professor, has been involved with the commission on this important human subject research work. So, as important as I believe personal health information privacy issues are, and as excited as I will be eventually to work on them in the context of the public commission, I recognize that other kinds of bioethical issues tied to a long list of 21st century health challenges may merit private attention. Yet, it isn't the case that bioethics, or by the way, the science media, allocate their attention to important matters in some sort of generally fair and wise way. It's a little bit arbitrary. So for me, the best example of this is cosmetic medicine. Right? Cosmetic surgery is not a big topic among bioethicists, and yet millions of people are turning to surgery to improve the appearance of their perfectly normal bodies, even their toes and genitalia. Breast implants, buttock implants, pectoral and calf implants. Should physicians be slicing open perfectly normal, healthy bodies and filling them with plastic and harvested fat just to realize some fleeting aesthetic preferences? I wish just a tiny portion of the attention given to women in persistent vegetative comas whose families want to unplug them went to women suffering the adverse consequences of liposuction, breast implants, and other fully elective procedures. So, cosmetic surgery and synthetic biology and cloning and stem cells and privacy. How do you decide, how do you prioritize which of these topics is the most important? Do you look at how much money is involved, how many lives are involved, whether it's life or death? I think the cosmetic surgery issue gets pushed to the background because we feel a little bit unimportant, I think, right, addressing cosmetic surgery. But when you think about what we're doing there, we really ought to be more concerned about the ethical implications of that. So returning to privacy, though, for a second, you know, there, too, there's a little bit of triage that goes on because some privacy topics are more important than others. Maybe the privacy issues of whole genome sequencing are, to some people, more important than the privacy issues raised by what can be posted on Facebook or on MySpace. But there are other privacy issues which clearly are less important. Example, last year, about a year ago, I read an article, the title of which was Mummy Rights, Do Ancient Dead People Deserve Medical Privacy? A pair of researchers, ethicists and anatomists in Switzerland, published a paper in the Journal of Medical Ethics arguing that probing a mummy is an invasive process that can reveal intimate facts. The mummy never gave informed consent for these procedures. Unquote. Well, you know, there's some silliness here. There's some important stuff here. And the silliness here is, of course, talking about mummies, you know, and people who have been dead for not just 100 years, but thousands of years. Right? But maybe if there's some DNA issues involved, it could be kind of tied to things that we care deeply about today. But focusing on the mummy qua mummy strikes me as being a little bit silly. It'd be a mistake, I believe, to focus on the problems of the long dead when we have nurses with fresh placenta on Facebook and hospital workers taking liberties with their ability to access online medical records. Now, our existing health laws were written to address the needs of a world with electronic health records. So back in the mid-1990s, 1995, 1996, we knew that this was coming. We're going to have a day when medical records were going to be electronic, and we knew we needed to have not just the nation's first federal health privacy law, but a federal health privacy law that was modern, that addressed modern concerns or concerns of electronic records. And so between 1995 and the early 2000s, when HIPAA went online, a lot of work went into thinking about, well, how can we make sure that records are secure when they're transferred from your doctor to the insurance company and so forth? What must be in place before a doctor can send you a copy of your medical record online? All that stuff got talked about. But what nobody could anticipate in 1995 was the Facebook.com, right? And no one had any clue that there would be a day when people were living their lives through an online social network and would be placing huge quantities of personal information about what they did every day online. But in this world, the world which combines just the fact of electronic records with a new culture, now we have to think about, well, does HIPAA or any of our health privacy laws really go to address the needs for protection of health information? So I propose a comprehensive sort of rethinking of medical privacy in light of the ease with which today it can be compromised. It's difficult to come up with a set of laws that can really, you know, prevent someone like Navy Tech from taking a peek. Right, a peeky see, taking a peek. But we've got to do something with our medical education, our training, our employment policies to make it less likely that people will put their curiosity above patient privacy. We've got to do something, I think, to address the ethics of this and to keep pace with the rapidly evolving social networking norms. Thank you. I'm told I get to answer questions or take comments or criticisms. Please. Yes, ma'am.
I'm particularly interested in people disclosing their mental health status or whether suffering from mental illnesses and depression. A lot of advocacy groups encourage people to share their experiences online, and especially when you move from the phenomenon of message boards, bulletin boards, to more public areas of Facebook or MySpace. Do you know of any particular privacy concerns that perhaps they should be looking at those cases where people may be giving away too much?
Great. So, yes. So, in the 90s and the early 2000s, there was a lot of encouragement of people to take part in message boards having to do with psychiatric drugs or with just their experiences. So people freely shared stories. And I actually agree that this is an incredibly useful thing to do if you can do it in a secure way, using anonymity to protect you from the consequences of disclosure. But the thing about Facebook, we've all had to learn the hard way, is that Facebook has gone from just being a place where you share with your true friends to a place where employers go to check you out before they hire you, right? And so because so few people truly understand how to block the outside world from what's there, now as a matter of due diligence, schools before they admit students will sometimes check their Facebook pages, employers will check Facebook pages. I know that judges chambers, I'm told, who judges who are about to hire Penn graduates, you know, might check out a Facebook page, because there you can really find out a lot about the character of the person that you're interested in. Now, I believe that actually people learn less than they think they learn from Facebook, but you can understand why if you can hire two people and one of them looks squeaky clean on Facebook and the other looks like a drunken idiot, you're going to hire the one who, you know, looks kind of cool. So people who want to share their mental health stories online, on Facebook, especially on MySpace, and don't know how to put in all the controls, really should think hard. It's going to go to their insurability because, of course, you know, if you have depression, it may make you less eligible for certain kinds of life insurance. And if you lie about having seen a doctor or having these problems, and yet the information is clearly available on Facebook, you might face not only embarrassment but possibly you know, some claim of fraud. So it's very important to be cautious. Very important. And I'm a lover of psychiatric memoirs, and the genre exists because people from Kay Jamison to Patty Duke, right, have written freely about their mental health problems, and it's helped the rest of us to understand that depression and even schizophrenia are common, treatable illnesses that professionals can have and even professionals can deal with. So I think it's very important to share, but caution about the sharing.
So today there's a lot of discussion on Facebook among the bioethicists or on some of the groups, because one of your colleagues on the council, Ansel Macy, had his Facebook account hacked, and it was a phony Facebook account. And it's been up for a while, and it's interesting that none of the bioethicists seem to be able to tell that it was phony. Postings were kind of there. So given the ability to hack almost anything, and given the fact that younger people are more used to revealing information in ways that maybe older Americans are not used to, is there really a future for privacy at all? I mean, forget about people who take pee, just people who maliciously can go in and grab information or create false sites. Seems to me the future isn't good.
Right, yes. And that kind of concern is what made me begin by saying, you know, something bad is happening, because I think that it's not clear that we will get through this period of increased use of social media with the taste for privacy or the capacity to have it if we want it. And I worry as much about the deterioration of the taste for privacy, because I do believe that whether you like it or not, it's good for you. But what you just said about the potential for hacking and database, it's huge. So, and it's hard to know how to what the next step should be. Should the next step be, let's go to Congress and urge stricter laws when we don't quite know what the culture is going to do in 6 months from now? You know, maybe there won't be a Facebook 6 months from now, or maybe we'll all gravitate towards some other something 6 months from now. You know, and if Facebook is dangerous, think how even more dangerous Twitter is, because it's just, I mean, very immediate. You know, got my, you know, lump negative or lump pot. I mean, you can really do a lot of quick, you know, thoughtless and unreflective disclosure using Twitter. But I think, you know, we are at a point where it's hard to know what to do next. My personal sense is that the thing we need to do next is to talk ethically as ethicists about this constantly, in order to influence the way young people and middle-aged people and elderly people see the privacy risk of using social media. And maybe through ethics, we can do some of the work, and then when we've come to sort of a period of stasis or some period of calm, we can adjust the laws to make it harder for someone like Navy Tech to just decide to go online without authorization to check out her distant relative's STD history.
By the way, just to follow up, I remember when Bill Clinton went in the hospital at Columbia for his heart procedure, a bunch of medical students took a look at his record and did get suspended. So there was more than a slap on the wrist that made him redo their semester. I think it was 20 students.
Yeah, and you know, given what happened with the placenta case, You got to worry, though, that maybe the courts might second-guess suspension, especially in a public medical school. So it's the Medical College of New Jersey, whatever it's called. If it's a public medical school or a public nursing school, it may be especially hard to enforce your ethics because you have due process issues and yada, yada. So, you know, great, I think, great thing to be that sensitive to privacy, but one wonders how universal that approach can be, how successful it can be across the gamut of cases. Yes, sir.
In the judge's decision that you cited, it seems as if the consumerist right seems to override any professional ethic.
The consumerist right override.
It could be the nursing student override the school's right to enforce a professional.
Yes. Well, yes, that's one way to think about it, that the, and this is not completely without precedent, to give you a parallel, in the area of hate speech, you know, so some public universities back in the 80s wanted to punish fraternity students who made racially or sexually inappropriate comments, but the federal court said no free speech. I think something similar or analogous happens here, where the school may have very strong ethical norms or especially strong honor code they want to enforce, but the courts say you can't do it, whether it's on constitutional grounds or on other grounds. And I think that may be a problem we have to look at. And I wonder whether some courts will actually be willing to give the schools more latitude, especially given the consequences for people like Candace. I mean, I think the placenta source is not seriously an issue here, but I mean, it could be a worse case where you had someone who was adversely affected. Yes?
What happened to the three other students? Would they be readmitted as well?
Well, you know, I didn't look hard enough to see whether they also brought their own lawsuits and how they were dealt with. But, you know, sometimes whether you are able to bring a lawsuit depends upon your personal resources. So I'm guessing that maybe the other girls didn't have the wherewithal, or they wrote in the coattails. Maybe they, you know, once she had her successful lawsuit, they went and said, "Well, now it's my turn. Put me back into it." I don't know whether they were admitted, but I think that given what happened to given what happened to Doyle Byrne, the school probably had to admit all the students who want to come back. Yes, ma'am. Yes.
How do you and your colleagues go about giving an opinion?
Great, thank you. So my I was very happy to be appointed by President Obama, but I imagined myself sitting in little rooms in Washington, D.C., writing reports constantly, you know, and it turns out that it's not that way at all. What the commission does is it meets in public sessions several times a year at pre-announced locations, and it hears testimony from brilliant experts like Arthur Kaplan, who come in and talk to us about the topic at hand, whether it's human subject research or neural imaging or synthetic biology. And then we make recommendations to the president. All of our work is to make recommendations to the president about topics either he gives us or that we ourselves generate. So we're giving the president some specific ideas about specific things he can do to protect ethical values that are sort of shared in public. And that's the format. And then the commission staff now is many members strong. There are recent college grads, there are senior scholars who work for the commission. There are science writers that work for the commission. They take the commission's commissioner's ideas and recommendations and put them into proper English and good form. And then we work collaboratively to come up with a draft document that we're all happy with. And that's perfected. And then we issue that to the president. And that's how we work. And the key thing here is it's all very public. We're actually not allowed to meet in private. So all of our deliberations take place in public. Sure.
Recommendations to the president, and as the executive, what can he do with? Because I can understand giving recommendations to legislators.
Yes.
What does he do with that kind of recommendation?
Well, if, for example, we recommend that the president task a particular agency to monitor, say, a certain industry, right? he can do that. He can ask the executive officer of various agencies to engage in certain kinds of activities on behalf of his administration. So he can ask NIH to do something in particular. He can ask the Department of Health and Human Services to do something in particular. He can ask the Office of Technology Assessment. So he has the power to go to the heads of agencies and to ask them to prioritize certain kinds of activities based on recommendations of the commission. And President Gutman was very wise, because what she did was, as soon as she was appointed, she actually went around to the heads of virtually every agency in Washington that has anything to do with healthcare or technology, and she asked them, what are the issues you're concerned about that relate to bioethics and technology? And so she has brought to the commission a very strong sense of what people are concerned about. So when our recommendations go from president to agency, they're not surprised, because it may be exactly what they want to do anyway, because they told us, we'd like you to think about this. Yes, sir.
You were talking about your interest in company activity, and since I guess the overall theme was about privacy, I was wondering if you or anyone else on your commission was interested in the recent surgeries in New York on pregnant women with the facial transplant, full facial transplant, and do you think it's possible to maintain privacy with somebody else's face on your head?
Art, come up here and answer that question. Just a couple of weeks ago, I heard Art Kaplan give a very nice talk about face transplants. He did raise the privacy issues, because if you're going to transplant a face, maybe the people for whom that face has significance should be brought into the equation in some way, by getting their permission or notifying them in advance. Maybe the person from whom the face was taken has privacy interests that need to be honored in some way. And there are many different ways to honor privacy and to honor the privacy of a deceased person. You can honor their privacy by not belittling them, by not demeaning them, by not disrespecting the value of the gift. So in that context, I think privacy may not be the best concept to capture all the things we worry about. We worry about dignity, and we worry about family feeling. But I think privacy is part of the story, because our face is the thing that the world sees us through, and we see the world through our faces, and we identify with our faces. And identity is one important sort of dimension of privacy. And so I think yes, it's there. And you're right; it does raise that question. But for me, The should doctors slice perfectly normal people up is not a question that I raise in the context of face transplants, because those are not elective. They are, at this point, experimental. And in that sense, I suppose they're elective. But there are surgeries that are designed to recreate function, to make it possible for someone, right, Art, to eat, to breathe easily, maybe even to see better. It's not just about looking cute, or strong, right? So my question about slicing normal bodies has to do with wanting to go from a B cup to a D cup, or wanting to have biceps as big as Arnold Schwarzenegger and doing it the easy way. Yeah. And because there are medical risks associated with those surgeries, and there have been injuries and death, I'm surprised that more bioethicists have not taken on that topic. I do not imagine that there will ever be a conversation about cosmetic surgery at the presidential commission level. But I would like us university folks to give it a bit more thought. Yes, one more? Okay, one more. Yes.
We share supplementation.
Yes.
Which just frightens me. There's all sorts of protection going on there, supposedly protection going on there. But how do the ethics and how the law keep up with the rapid IT changes? We're talking about cloud-based applications now. 6 months is good, something else.
Yeah.
How do we struggle with that?
Well, we struggle and we don't keep up, right? So, and I'm glad this question was asked, and so I will end here. But you're absolutely right. We went from just doctors in the 19th century knowing stuff, remembering stuff in their head, right, to doctors writing things on paper and creating a paper record, to providers creating systems of records, paper records, to electronic records, and now to cloud computing. And cloud computing, for those of you who don't know, just refers to the practice of third-party storage. So maybe the Fairview Clinic doesn't want to just have their own electronic database in-house. They may want to hire a third-party entity, maybe even Google, to store all their records sort of in some other location, so that if their own local servers are destroyed or whatever, there'll be a permanent, more protected, backed-up copy of all the information. But that means that the information is going from me, the patient, to the provider, to the entity, the hospital site, to the cloud, and there's so many places in that transmission of data where data can be lost, leaked, hacked into, stolen, and so it's a real problem. And I think that, as I said before, if you try to change the law too quickly to deal with technology, you're going to be always a little bit behind because things are happening too fast. So you have to kind of pause and wait and see and pause and wait and see. But in the meantime, I think ethics can help to fill the gap. Thank you.
Okay. So for those of you who are joining us for the MBE graduation ceremony, we're going to go that way. Great, following Nora to the Hall of Flags. And once again, thank you so much. It was great. Thanks.